Coming up, a Muslim elementary and junior high school in Buffalo that teaches the regular New York State curriculum plus a lot more.
We hope to instill in our children what it takes to be a responsible, caring, and giving person who is God conscious.
And a concert honoring defiant Jewish prisoners in a Nazi concentration camp.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Violent demonstrations broke out in Haiti this week over allegations of fraud in the recent presidential election. This on top of the growing cholera epidemic. Several relief organizations say the unrest has been preventing them from treating the thousands of Haitians suffering from the illness. More than 2,000 people have died, and more than 100,000 have become sick. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, has been talking to relief workers in Haiti. Kim, what do they tell you?
Well, they're telling me that the situation is a lot more difficult than many people here may realize. The political unrest, protests in the streets, sometimes violent clashes have really created a situation where it's hard for people to get around. Many of the relief groups and the faith-based groups have been on lockdown for several days in Port-au-Prince, but also in other cities around Haiti.
Lockdown meaning they don't go anywhere?
They're told don't go anywhere, don't go on the streets. I understand that you can't even get anywhere if you try to get on the streets. Mm-hmm. There are these big barricades and even stones and rocks. Sadly, Haitians are dragging rubble from the earthquake that still hasn't been cleared away. They're dragging that in the streets so people can't get around, which means the workers can't get to the cholera clinics. They can't get to the rebuilding projects. And it just puts all of that help further back.
And as you indicated, it does seem as if it's worse than a lot of us had thought.
Well, as you know, I was supposed to be down there right now with a TV crew for our program, and our flight got canceled. There was an Episcopal delegation with the presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church. Their plans got canceled, postponed anyway. They're trying to figure out what to do. A lot of people can't come and go because the airports have been closed. That's how bad the situation has been.
Yeah. And all this pent-up fury from a year ago when the earthquake, almost a year, when the earthquake hit, it just must have magnified the response to the election results.
Well, some of the people I've been talking to say this protest and all of this violence isn't just about politics and the election. It's about the frustration of the people and their plight so long with, you know, not having a place to live, 1.5 million people still living in tents and tarps, now the cholera epidemic, and they're just very frustrated.
Yeah. Kim, many thanks. In other news, Congress failed to act this week in Washington on several issues of importance to the religious community. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim groups had lobbied hard for the DREAM Act, which would have created a path to citizenship for the undocumented children of illegal immigrants. But that legislation stalled in the Senate, as did the attempt to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the ban on gays serving openly in the military. And it's still uncertain whether the Senate will ratify the START Treaty on nuclear weapons. In Norway, Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. The Chinese government refused to let Liu Xiaobo attend the ceremony. He remains in prison. But the prize committee left an empty chair. Several demonstrators gathered in Norway to protest China's record on human rights. In Beijing, authorities increased security at the country's universities in anticipation of protests there. In California, a federal appeals court heard arguments in the legal challenge to Proposition 8, the state's ban on gay marriage. In August, a federal judge ruled the ban was unconstitutional. This week, leaders of several religious groups issued a statement calling for the protection of traditional marriage. They said marriage between a man and a woman is fundamental to the well-being of all society. Signers included prominent Catholics, evangelicals, and Mormons, as well as Sikh and Orthodox Jewish leaders. A new report says the institution of marriage is in trouble among so-called middle Americans, the 58% of adults with a high school diploma but no four-year college degree. Divorce rates are up, and in what the report calls a historic reversal, commitment to marriage among the moderately educated is now less strong than it is among the highly educated. Among the reasons listed are unemployment and falling church attendance. Bradford Wilcox of the University of Virginia, the author of the report, says children and adults in an intact family are more likely than others to succeed in life. The retreat from marriage in middle America, says Wilcox, means that all too many Americans will not be able to realize the American dream. Now, a special report on a private Muslim school in Buffalo. The curriculum meets all the New York State requirements, but students here are also taught values, discipline, Arabic, and God consciousness. Lucky Severson reports.
The first thing an outsider might notice at the Universal School in Buffalo is how well behaved the students are. The chaos that sometimes erupts between classes at public schools is not to be found here. Universal is an Islamic school for students in pre-K through 8th grade. It's one of 240 private Islamic schools in the country and is supported through tuition and fundraising. Kathy Jamil is a principal.
We hope to instill in our children what it takes to be a responsible, caring, and giving person who is God conscious. And we believe that we can only do that if we develop a whole child. So we focus on academics, but it's just one small part of everything else. Because actually, if we can hit the other realms, we feel like the academics just skyrocket.
God consciousness, they say, is meant to be a constant state of awareness of Allah throughout the day. Tamara Osman directs the Islamic Studies program.
There are times when students are traveling in the hallway that maybe an adult's eye may not beyond them for just that moment. If they remember that God is watching me, they may not do those type of things that we find in other schools, whether it's ridicule other students or bullying. We have a lot less of those type of things at the school here, and I think part of that reason is because we are trying to inculcate the idea of God consciousness in the children.
They are reminded of God five times each day during prayer. Universal is a state-accredited school, so the students are taught the same curriculum as those in public schools, and their test scores are on grade level or above. But here they're also taught Arabic and Islamic studies, including the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. They learn about values from the teachings of the Prophet.
The Prophet, peace be upon him, as we believe, is the best of all mankind. And he embodied all of the beautiful qualities and characteristics that we want to work on in our lives.
One of the wisdoms in Islamic schools today is that if you look at our core American values, they coincide with a lot of our Islamic values.
Those shared interests apparently include the love of sports, like soccer, which is popular in many of the different countries these kids' families emigrated from. But one of the challenges at Universal is to separate the religion from the attitudes of the culture they left behind. Attitudes, for instance, detrimental to women.
I work with some domestic violence clients here in the United States in relation to immigrant families and Muslim families. And with the conversations that I have with the court systems, you will hear a man walk on, sit on the stand and say, I have the right to, from a religious perspective. And we're there saying, you absolutely do not. You clearly don't understand your faith tradition.
Islam considers homosexuality a sin. And in some Muslim countries, the punishment is severe.
Being gay is forbidden in Islam, but you cannot make fun of that group or people who are like that. You're supposed to be nice to everybody, but you can't. It's still forbidden. You can't do that.
As Muslims, we shouldn't be judgmental. Just like in many of the other faiths, is that it is frowned upon. It's not seen as something that's praiseworthy, but at the same time, it's not. We don't see it as if the person does that, then that's it. They're condemned forever.
The school found its home in an unlikely place, a former Catholic church and convent. Students from Universal and St. Monica Catholic School share interfaith programs throughout the year. Nancy Langer is with St. Monica.
What I've noticed is that they don't seem to look at each other and see any differences. They seem to accept each other for who they are, and they've become instant friends. It's really wonderful.
Universal opened its doors 3 days before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Suddenly there were bomb threats. Police were patrolling the school. Not a good time to be a Muslim in America. And it was perhaps the worst time to open an Islamic school.
That evening we had an emergency board meeting. It was just silence. Everyone was just quiet. We didn't know what to say. We didn't know what to think. We didn't know what to do.
Ultimately, they decided that keeping the school open presented an opportunity to reach out to the inner city neighborhood that surrounds the school. Ray Barker teaches social studies. He's not a Muslim, but is impressed with the mission of the school.
It is really looking at developing the whole person through a moral structure set up by the religion. It very much is creating a strong foundation for them for these years and the rest of their lives.
You just do good in school.
And so are you good all the time?
For some parents, learning good values was only one reason they wanted their children in a religious school. Even before she gave birth to her three kids, Maha Zatra didn't care whether they went to an Islamic school or a Catholic school, as long as it wasn't a public school.
Discipline, really. That was my concern, discipline. Respect to their parents, respect older people. That was my first goal.
Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he talked about how important gentleness was, that God is gentle and he loves gentleness. At our school, you will find it's very rare that we would have a teacher raise their voice.
They may not raise their voices, but they do achieve discipline. Listen to Alet and Hakim.
You know that room downstairs right before you come up here, the library? In there, you spend the whole day with, you know, the guy at the desk downstairs, Brother Jabber? Oh, man, he could give some punishments.
Like what?
He gives us all these writing to do, and, like, sometimes, like last year, there's this other hall monitor. They're kind of strict. If you walk down the wrong way, they make you, like, walk up and down, like, 80 times.
It gets me worried to know the fact that when my daughter is a teenager, she's going to start thinking, I want to date, I want to go here, I want to go there.
She needn't worry about Universal. Dating is not allowed here for a host of reasons. Some are found in the Quran's views on chastity, when it refers to Maryam, whom Christians call Mary, the mother of Jesus.
In the Quran, God uses Maryam as the example for our young girls on how he had so much love for her because of her chastity, because of her modesty before God, because of her purity and her internal beauty. And that's all part of it. We don't want to necessarily come down on them saying dating is bad, dating is bad, dating is good. Rather, we want to tell them how positive a healthy family is.
Why do you think that it is that that they don't want you to date?
Because you don't want any, diseases. Because the STDs going around.
Values are enforced and behaviors like gossip and bullying strongly condemned. Bullying is a very real and personal concern for these students. Some come looking for a safe environment.
Why were you bullied?
I was bullied because I'm Muslim. I got, punched a couple of times.
Girls who wear the headscarf, the hijab, often feel the insecurity of being the object of stares, of being different. Some wear their hijabs only at school. Others wear them as a badge of honor.
I started wearing hijab when I was little, in first grade. I've been wearing it since then, outside even. And people just used to look at me, and then I used to have to act like them, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be me.
So they made you feel bad, huh? Do you think Muslims get a bad rap in this country?
Yeah. Because they don't know who we are.
If they see the truth, it's very obvious, that we're good people.
Lackawanna for dismissal, Lackawanna for dismissal.
Universal started with 17 students. Today they have over 100. The eventual goal is to expand Universal to include high school. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Buffalo, New York.
In Rome this week, several tourists got a glimpse of Pope Benedict XVI as he traveled to the city's famous Spanish Steps. The Pope was marking the Feast of the Immaculate Conception with a visit to a nearby shrine to the Virgin Mary. The traditional visit begins the Christmas season in Rome. This time of religious holidays, we have a powerful story about courage and humanity in the face of brutal oppression. In one of the Nazi concentration camps during World War II, there was a Jewish prison choir. The members learned Verdi's famous Requiem Mass with its plea to God for deliverance from evil. Survivors said they derived great inner strength from singing the Requiem to their captors. Bob Fall reports.
Every note and inside of every note, inside of every note.
In a Washington, D.C. church, an impassioned conductor implores his choir.
Don't move. Don't move. Very nice. What you're doing is very nice, and there's no room for that. It has to be extraordinary. You know, the sort of thing that you will remember all of your lives.
Whenever he can, Murray Sidlin urges them to do more. Because what they are rehearsing, what they are trying to commemorate, is another performance by another choir in horrific circumstances. Jewish prisoners in a Nazi concentration camp.
To us, it's just damn words. They leave the rehearsal and walk over bodies to get back to their barracks. We cannot be indifferent.
This music, Verdi's lyrical Mass for the Dead, is a full-throated testament to the majesty and judgment of God. Profound, even in this rehearsal at Washington's Kennedy Center, but it was perhaps never more powerful or poignant than its performance on June 23, 1944, in the concentration camp Terezin, just outside Prague, when Jewish prisoners sang the Requiem to their Nazi captors. That Catholic Mass, says Terezin survivor Vera Schiff, gave prisoners a way to defy the Nazis.
The text of the Latin prayers suggests that we all will be judged by the Almighty, and this will include the Germans. There was a promise that the day will come in which we all will be facing the final judge. And that gave us a great deal of satisfaction and hope.
It was cathartic, therapeutic, and important for them to remain dignified. They responded to the worst of mankind with the best of mankind. This is our way of fighting back.
In the cold, filth, and misery of a camp like this, a Romanian-born conductor, Raphael Schechter, gathered 150 fellow prisoners and in a dank basement with just one score and a broken piano, taught them, by rote, Verdi's sublime work. Choir member Edgar Crossa says Schechter was extraordinary.
Socially, he was a wonderful person, but once he sat behind his piano, he was a real tyrant.
The survivors who sang in this chorus said to me that when he started work on the Requiem, and this is a quote, he was like a crazed man on a mission. He began to say things to them such as, we can sing to them what we cannot say to them.
Through the words in this Catholic liturgy, a Jewish chorus could stand up to the Nazis by letting them know what ultimately matters. Nazi propaganda films were made at Terezin to give the false impression Jews were happy there, well-fed and cared for. When officials from the International Red Cross visited, things were spruced up even more. The Nazis asked Raphael Schechter to perform that Requiem for their guests. They probably couldn't understand the Mass sung in Latin, but Schechter and his choir understood exactly what they were doing.
Here I can really make a difference. And not to all mankind, to myself, to my friends, to my colleagues, to my family, I can make a difference. I can sing what I can't say. I can respond in the best possible way to the unspeakable horror in which I find myself.
Performers could be deported to the gas chambers at Auschwitz, warned Jewish elders in the camp, if the Nazis understood the lyrics. So Schechter gave his chorus a choice.
Pell told us about the danger and said, if you, whoever is afraid, there's the door and you can go. Nobody left.
No one left.
No.
The lyrics of the Requiem and their hidden meaning were the source of the prisoner's defiance. The second and longest movement, for example, tells of the day of wrath, Dies Irae. The day of wrath, that day will dissolve the world in ashes. How great will be the terror when the judge comes, is how the Latin is translated.
It's very simple. God's in charge of humanity. And if anybody fools around with that, they're going to hear from God.
Or take the final section, Libera Me.
Liberate me eternally from eternal death. Terezin was eternal death. Through this music, they found the mechanism by which they could sing to God with assurance that God's presence is with them. And so I think they found in this work a spiritual reawakening or a spiritual reassurance.
The singing of Verdi at Terezin had a profound impact on the prisoners and singers, like survivor Marianka Zadiko-May, speaking recently at a symposium.
We wanted to be liberated and just hope that there is a loving Hashem in heaven who will hear you and liberate you.
In the wretched camp, says survivor Vera Schiff, Verdi's Requiem was a lifeline.
It was part of the defines to keep up our spirits, to keep us in a frame of mind to want to live, to want to live another day. That was helping over the hunger, over the illnesses and deprivation, and that carries you a long way under the circumstances when we feared for our life day by day.
We felt great because otherwise we had no opportunity to show the Nazis that we're not afraid of them.
Schechter conducted Verdi's Requiem 16 times at Terezin. After the final 1944 performance, he and most of the chorus were shipped off to the gas chambers at Auschwitz. For the few survivors, remembering brings pain and pride.
I think it brings back twofold emotions. The emotion, of course, of sadness, because in my case, I've lost all my entire family. But simultaneously, I think I find that it was a great achievement of what people can do under unimaginable circumstances.
This was not commemorating death. It was commemorating the beauty and importance of life.
When the Requiem ends in the multimedia concert Murray Sidlin created to commemorate Terezin, the mournful wail of a train whistle sounds. And as the audience watches film of Jewish prisoners being transported to Nazi crematoriums, one solo violin plays an ancient Jewish song which the condemned sang on their way to death. A haunting tribute to Terezin, where in defiance there was affirmation, indeed, a kind of triumph. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Washington.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, find us on YouTube, and watch us on smartphones and iPhones with our new mobile web app. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, 10-year-old singer Jackie Yvonne Coe performs O Holy Night at Thursday's lighting of the National Christmas Tree in Washington.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.